طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your interim host, Bob Funk. For today's subject on This Week in Palestine, Israel is committing genocide against the entire population of Gaza, using money and weapons eagerly furnished by our so-called leaders in Congress and the White House, and, by extension, involuntarily paid for by U.S. taxpayers. Confronted with this moral disaster, college and university students who care are protesting just as loudly as possible. Most of these students, institutional administrators, seem to like the status quo, and with the police at their beck and call, go after the protesters. That's what today's show is about. For this, we are indebted to Al Shabak, the Palestinian Policy Network, and our podcast-wise tech staff. Samer Elatut Al Shabaka, policy analyst and professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, joins host Yara Hawari to speak about his experience at a student encampment where he was assaulted and detained by police. Alatut also touches on the overall significance of the student uprising in the U.S. against genocide in Gaza. Here we go.
Do I trust the institution? No, but what I do trust is the community that was created. And the community that was created is really powerful. The students are amazing. The faculty and staff that were involved in the encampment are amazing. This coalition that was built will not disappear. There are a lot of steps that are to be taken during the summer and the fall and the spring that I think will lead to a change in the form of discussion that's happening now.
From Ashabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network, I am Yara Hawari, and this is Rethinking Palestine. Over a month ago, students at Columbia University in New York set up an encampment on campus grounds in solidarity with the Palestinian people, especially those in Gaza facing the ongoing genocide. Their demands to the university administration are simple: to disclose and divest from those complicit in the oppression of Palestinians. This encampment shortly led to other student encampments across American university campuses and now even further afield, including the UK and beyond, all under the banner of disclose and divest from genocide. Whilst perhaps unprecedented in the case of Palestine, these encampments and protests follow a long legacy of student mobilization in the US against imperialism and war. And just as their predecessors did, these students at these encampments have faced brutal repression from police and security forces. Hundreds of students and faculty members have been injured, arrested, and even suspended from their institutions. They've also faced smear campaigns by the media and agitators who tried to paint the picture of hate-filled, violent protests when in fact the opposite has been true. Palestinian-American Professor Samer Elatut is the Buttle Sewell Professor in the Department of Community and Environmental Sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, as well as a faculty advisor for the Students for Justice in Palestine chapter at the university and a member of Ashabaka. Professor Elatut was at his local student encampment when he was assaulted and detained by police. And today he joins me on this episode of Rethinking Palestine to discuss the significance of this student uprising from the perspective of a faculty member. Professor Elatut, thank you for joining me on this episode of Rethinking Palestine.
Thank you, Yara.
Professor, before we go into what happened to you, it would be useful to hear a little bit about the background to these protests and encampments as you understand them.
Well, I mean, there is a long history in the United States of student activism, and university campuses have been famously busy with protest during, for example, the civil rights movement in the 1960s, during anti-war, anti-Vietnam War movement in the 1960s and 70s, then anti-apartheid movement in the 1980s, and now, of course, against Israeli apartheid, occupation, and genocide in U.S. universities. So there is a long history of student activism, and almost always those student activist movements have been brutalized by police force and police violence, and almost always they affected change. So while they are ongoing, they are faced with violence, and then within a decade or so, they seem to be succeeding in changing the discourse around, for example, Vietnam War or civil rights or apartheid South Africa. They seem to have changed the discourses around those, and you end up with a tidal kind of wave of change in general, right? Not only at the university level. And so usually people, when people talk about student movements in the US, people are often proud of those movements, of course, in hindsight, right? So for example, the university here, university chancellor in the 1980s apologized about how the university dealt with the students during Civil War, right? So they issued an official apology for how they brutalized the students in the 1960s and 70s. So they recognized that later on, but at the time that these movements happen, there is a lot of brutalization.
That's really important historical background to today's student protests, which obviously are anti-war and anti-genocide, but they also have specific demands around disclosure and divestment. Is it common for American universities to have investments in companies that are complicit with the Israeli regime's oppression of the Palestinian people?
Yeah, I don't know how many people recognize how that investment happens, but there is, you know, each university has an endowment of some sort. And what that means is that the university has funds that come from gifts or profits from inventions at the university. So those funds become huge at points. For example, my university has about $4 billion. Harvard, of course, has more than $50 billion. But in total, I think the largest 15 universities have about $320 billion in their endowments. And so what the universities do is that they invest those endowments in funds, right, in diversified kind of portfolios of basically buying stocks in companies. And so usually these are hidden, though we don't know where these stocks are, but there is so much investment, for example, in Lockheed Martin or Hewlett Packard or Motorola Solutions. And all of these provide aid to Israeli genocide and Israeli occupation. So, for example, Lockheed Martin sells F-16s, and those were prominent in what happens in Gaza now and in other places, of course, during the last four decades, right? HP, which is Hewlett Packard, has biometric systems that are used by Israelis to surveil and to follow Palestinians throughout the West Bank and Gaza. Motorola provides surveillance to Israeli security systems. Elbit Systems also, which builds drones, which is an Israeli company, builds drones and surveillance systems. And there are so many others. So the universities, because the funds that they have are invested in portfolios, so which means a group of stocks, they do invest in these companies. And of course, those endowments, I mean, the money that comes the profits that come out of that investment goes into doing research and salaries and stuff like that for the working of the university. I mean, there is so much investment in Israeli companies. The problem that we are having now is that we don't know what the investment, right, is. So, for example, at my university, and I think this is very typical of other universities, the university's foundation, which has the money and invests it, is created as a separate entity from the university itself. So there is no control. The university does not control the foundation. And the foundation actually is not very open about its investment strategies or about its investments. So we don't know anything about what kinds of investments are there or where do they have them. The assumption is that they have them in these companies. Definitely sure. I mean, but we need to know more about where this money is.
And that seems like quite a reasonable demand to ask for disclosure. And it's not actually unusual for students to ask for divestment, right? It actually does fit in the context of this long history of student activism against US imperialism and war that you previously mentioned.
Definitely. I mean, one thing that this movement of students at this time asks for, if you can see the slogans, are disclosure first, right? Disclosure basically means that these funds should actually tell us, transparency in the investment should tell us where the money is invested. And that's a very basic democratic principle for especially public universities, but even private universities, to know where the investment is going. So disclosure is really important. And this is what we are fighting for now. And then the other thing is divestment. And divestment has been practiced often. So, for example, during the anti-apartheid movement, that was precisely what the students were asking for during the late 70s and 1980s. The students asked that universities divest from businesses that enable apartheid in South Africa. And like I said before, all of these companies that I mentioned are enabling Israeli occupation, genocide, displacement of Palestinians, etc. And the assumption that we cannot actually know if the university is investing in them and whether it's profiting out of death and war is really important. And so the anti-apartheid movement succeeded in the end, in forcing the universities to divest. But also it succeeded even in a larger scheme of things, which means that businesses started to divest from South Africa and other private companies started to do that, not only the public.
And divestment has been a demand of Palestinian civil society by consensus for nearly two decades now. So the students are very much answering that call that was made by the BDS movement in the early 2000s.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what happened in the United States, I cannot speak for other countries or other regions, but in the United States, BDS became a somewhat normal discourse. What I mean by that is that there is so much push against BDS, of course, in the US, right, on a governmental scale. So the Congress is intervening. Even here, the Assembly, for example, in Wisconsin, and the Senate, the local, our local governance institutions have written laws that we cannot actually boycott Israel and we cannot divest from Israel, that any calls for that is illegal. But at the same time, you find that there is a public discourse that is invigorated initially by BDS movement, but here, because Palestinian voices are becoming much stronger, they are becoming profoundly effective in the U.S., and which was not the case a few years back, right? And I think that has to do with maybe social media, but also with the fact that probably Palestinian American scholars and activists have been probably kind of reached to a point where they do not want to be silenced anymore and in the background. And I think they are taking the risks and willing to take the risks. So, for example, myself or other people, a lot of people in the U.S. are taking so much risks, not from universities, because in the end, I'm tenured, for example, which means that I have certain protections for my job, but also being able to stand firm against Zionist propaganda, against organizations that mobilize in order to attack Palestinian voices and Palestinian activists. So there is a sense in which we actually stepped beyond the line that used to scare us from speaking out. And so now when they speak against us, we speak and we defend and we argue. And I think there is something that has shifted. And maybe more Palestinians are here in the U.S. too. And more organizing happened in the last 20 years, right? And of course, the BDS successes that happened in the last 20 years also proved to have been effective somehow. And so the question is how to carry that forward into the future. And I think the student movement is taking all of that experience into account while working for divestment at this point in the United States.
If you're enjoying this podcast, please visit our website, al-shabaka.org, where you will find more Palestinian policy analysis and where you can join our mailing list and donate to support our work. Columbia University was the first encampment in the US, student encampment, and there's been a lot of media attention on it. So I was wondering if you could perhaps tell us a bit about what's been happening at your university, the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and perhaps also share with us what happened to you when you visited your student encampment.
So at my university, the students started an encampment on the 29th of April, on a Monday. And the encampment was amazingly beautiful. I mean, that's the thing that people don't understand sometimes, is that the students are able to create a world that we all look forward to live in. Our students built an encampment that included Jewish, Muslim, Christian, any number of religions, right? Any number of races, any number of countries of origin. Such a beautiful presence of a community, and started to cultivate a communal context that is really unheard of within Madison. So many people will say, especially people of color and people who are from other places, from other countries, so many of them were commenting about how the encampment is the only place that they have felt that they are recognized, seen, and appreciated. And so there was a cultivation of a different kind of relation, right, between people. And what happened is that the university refused to talk to the students before they take out the camp. And of course, the students refused to take out the camp because, you know, I mean, the tents were, on the one hand, symbolic because of what's happening in Gaza. And the students wanted to symbolize that with a real image of tents and by sleeping there. And the other thing is that they felt that relation between the administration and them is a relation of power that is undergirded by the notion that the administration can call the police and can resort to police violence at any moment. So there was a threat the whole time. If you do not take the encampment down, we will call the police. And if you don't take the encampment down, we will not talk with you. And in the meantime, we were talking to the administration, asking them to talk to the students, and they refused. So Wednesday morning comes, and we hear that the police is coming, and then we go staff, faculty, and other students who are not in the encampment, we go there in order to kind of have build a human chain around the encampment to protect them. And this is where, I mean, I think maybe one should talk about, maybe I should talk about my role as a professor and how I see myself. I mean, I think often we forget the elements of being a professor that are really more important than just the pedagogical and the educational kind of elements. And those are that we are there to nurture the students, right? To protect them. And sometimes we protect them in terms of livelihood. Sometimes we protect them in terms of, in emotional terms. For whatever reasons, I take that really seriously, that we are there to love them and to have them. They are part of us, right? To cultivate this sort of community or kinship relations, right? Rather than relation of power that is built on law or regulations. So to cultivate that relationship is really important for me as a professor. And so when that happened, I stood between them and the police, and I was all the time in contact with the police and the administration, urging them not to escalate and to de-escalate when they came into the encampment. And they didn't. So they came forward. And I mean, I think I was targeted in part because I'm a Palestinian. But in general, I mean, if you look at it, the police violence led to the detainment of four professors. And guess what? All four professors are professors of color. And that was a huge embarrassment to the university and even the students. Most of the ones who were attacked violently and arrested were students of color. And that's not because there were no white professors or staff or students. There were a lot. But so that begs the question of how the police decides and whether they are trained well enough in protecting civil rights of minority or people of color. In any case, so they attacked us, and I of course tried to stay my ground, and I got hurt, and I got, I guess maybe you saw the pictures and videos because it became a viral moment. I got injured, but in the end, after that, the administration said we will meet with the students. I mean, they took the tents down, but in the end, the students put them up within an hour. So the encampment continued. And that proved to the administration that they are actually fighting the will of the students and that it will not work that way. And I think there was an embarrassment that kind of spread within the administration about the fact that, you know, for faculty of color, but also the violence, the police violence that was enacted, especially in response to a very peaceful encampment that was all about poetry, music, and celebration, right, of life. So that's what happened. And then at some point, I was in the mediating, kind of in the negotiation team. At some point, I withdrew from it because I was really angry with the administration about how they are sending out messages that the reason I was detained is because I was violent. And I thought that they were doing that underhandedly. And I decided to withdraw from the meetings. But comes Monday, and there was a big break in the conversation between the students and the administration. The students withdrew from the discussion, from the conversation, because rightly so, because they felt that the administration is not giving them anything and they are not moving on their requests. I kind of like tried to intervene so that the police is not called again, and probably had a hand in getting the chancellor to meet with the students, which was a demand of the students. And so the next day she met with them. And I mean, we ended up with an agreement that does not fulfill the issue of disclosure and divestment. It does give some wins. For example, there will be a person will be hired to look into people who come from war torn countries and displaced people, especially Gaza, and that's in the agreement. The agreement also stipulated that it's an agreement between the administration and SJP, Students for Justice in Palestine, which has been dehumanized for the last year across the US. and that actually was good. Then there was an agreement that they will bring three scholars from Palestinian academic institutions, like one a year with extensions possible. And also that they will review all of the international division programs with an eye on increasing potential for helping students who come from Gaza or the West Bank. And so there were a few things, but I think the recognition is that the chancellor herself cannot dictate to the foundation what to do or not to do with the money. However, she committed to have meetings with the foundation and stuff like that. But now we have in the Faculty Senate, which is the governance institution of the faculty, we have resolutions that are going to go through, hopefully in the fall, beginning of the fall, on divestment and disclosure. So we are working on those already. Actually, they are almost ready to be introduced early in the fall.
It's not a surprise that police patterns of brutality are reflected on these campuses, you know, targeting people of color. You know, for centuries, people of color have always been the first ones to be brutalized by police and security forces. So that at all is not surprising. But I do want to take a moment and reflect on what you said at the beginning of the answer to that last question, that these spaces really cultivated what a different kind of society could look like. And I think in and of itself, that is somewhat of a movement gain. You know, a lot of people are talking about what a win looks like in these situations of these encampments. And I think there are so many gains that have been made, even if some students and some campuses haven't been able to achieve their original demands. And that sort of leads me on into my next question about these big conversations around, you know, when the encampment ends or when students enter into those conversations with administrations. There are so many different factors to take into consideration. You know, not all campuses are the same, not all student groups are the same, people studying and working in different environments. And so I think that question and that conversation will be ongoing, I think, for months to come. But do you have hope, or do you trust the administration that they will continue this conversation around disclosure and divestment? Because even though that has been a promise by the chancellor, as you said, a lot of people might not have faith in the fact that that might actually happen.
That's a great question. Well, in the agreement, there are timelines for all of these things. So the students can always pressure the institution because of the timelines. Like, there are deadlines for when each of the demands will be accomplished or each of the wins. But I'll go back to your question about the new kind of world that we are, that the students have been successful in creating. And I think the argument from my perspective to the administration from the beginning has been that they are, by threatening police force, that what they seem to imply is that the administration is the university. I said it often to them that the administration is not the university, that the university is a constellation of groups, students, faculty, staff, and the administration. And that shared governance means that we all have a stake in how the institution presents itself and represents us. And that we need to be able to feel that we belong, right? The students, from the students' perspective, they need to know that they belong. And the way that they know that they belong is by actually participating in governing the institution itself. And what my argument has been all the time is that the threat of violence builds a relation of power that basically pits the university administration and the students on two opposite sides and does not see them as working for the same institution, right? And so I argued often that the administration needs to actually try to think of the students as of it, for it, from it, right? They belong to us. And the same with faculty and staff. And that to work in order to cultivate those relations of kinship, that relations shouldn't be between administration, students, staff, and faculty those relations shouldn't be relations of power and force that are undergirded by the threat of violence, but should be relations of kinship and belonging, then the encampment can be seen as a protest by the students that is trying to tell the administration, we need a voice in the governance of the institution. We need a voice in investment, how investment is done. What are the ethics of investments? How do we decide on what to invest in where, right? So I think the answer to your question, do I trust the institution to do that? No, I do not trust the institution. But what I do trust is the community that was created. And the community that was created is really powerful. So the students are amazing. The faculty and staff that were involved in the encampment or around it are amazing. And all of this, this coalition that was built, will not disappear. And it's already working on next steps, right? So there are a lot of steps that are to be taken during the summer and the fall and the spring that I think will lead to a change in the discussion, in the form of discussion that's happening now. And I think, you know, I mean, the administration, one of the things the administration has been doing is that saying that the encampment is illegal, right? And that because it's illegal, we are bringing police force. And I keep thinking of how their understanding that the encampment is a state of exception, right? That it is an exceptional protest maneuver by the students, and that that necessitates police force, while they don't reflect, and that's really ironic, they don't reflect that the students are doing that because of the exceptional status of Gaza, because there is a genocide. And that's an exception, right? I mean, if there is an exception of genocide that's happening in Gaza or anywhere in the world, and the students take it upon themselves to actually stop that genocide or help in the steps that will lead to stopping the genocide and the occupation and the apartheid regime, it is because that is exceptional that they actually went the exceptional route of building encampment. And the administration fails to see how Gaza is actually exceptional or that it is a genocide. And they need to rethink that.
And I think just because some of the encampments have ended, it doesn't mean that the movement has. If anything, this has been and continues to be such a huge win for the movement. And I think we need to be more mindful and reflect on the gains that have been made. And one of the ones that you've highlighted has been the widening of this coalition, of this community that insists that this genocide won't be committed in their name. And this is my final question, and maybe a bit repetitive, but as a faculty member and as a Palestinian, how do you see your role in this student uprising?
It's a really interesting thing because in a way, I wanted to contribute as much as possible of my knowledge and whatever experience, right, in Palestine and here and through my studies and whatever, my academic kind of understandings of the situation. But also, I wanted to be able to let the students lead because they are amazing. I mean, they are really, even the student negotiators, I mean, we're just powerful, so powerful and very, very proud of them. And so the challenge of understanding your role as an advisor, in my case, or other faculty also as supporters, but at the same time that it is a student-led movement. And so to kind of frame it in that way, sometimes you will have to back up and just let the students do what the students do. And you just, my role is as a support. So I saw myself as supporter of the students. I did participate in the negotiations and the mediation with the administration, but for the most part, I saw it as support of the students and students' ideas. And, you know, at times I gave them my opinion if they asked for it, But in general, I was just there to support them. And I said, I mean, like I said to the, even to the faculty senate and to the chancellor that, you know, if you bring the police again, I am going to be there. So it's like you're setting the whole community in an upheaval because I will not let the students be brutalized. Whatever happens to the students should happen to me and to the other faculty and staff. And so I hope they understood that.
Professor, thank you so much for your time, and I'm grateful for your safety following your experience at the student encampments. We hope to have you on Rethinking Palestine again soon. Rethinking Palestine is brought to you by Ashabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network. Ashabaka is the only global independent Palestinian think tank whose mission is to produce critical policy analysis and collectively imagine a new policy-making paradigm for Palestine and Palestinians worldwide. For more information or to donate to support our work, visit al-shabaka.org. And importantly, don't forget to subscribe to Rethinking Palestine wherever you listen to podcasts.
The following is the obituary for John W. Roberts, as in the Boston Globe, 26 May 2024. John W. Roberts, who led the state ACLU in protecting free speech and abortion rights, dies at 89. Which issue caused the most controversy during 32 years that John W. Roberts led the American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts? He knew the choices were many. Finding ACLU policies with which one disagrees is easy, noted Mr. Roberts, who led the state chapter from 1970 to 2002 in a 1988 letter to the editor of the Boston Globe. High on the list of his 10 years headline-grabbing moments was the ACLU's stance supporting the free speech rights of Nazi groups and the office's threat to file suit when the state of Massachusetts considered keeping the name of former Ku Klux Klan Grand Wizard David Duke off the 1992 Republican presidential primary ballot. "You don't want those cases," Mr. Roberts told the Globe just before stepping down as the chapter's executive director. "You go, oh no, give me a break." But there's a guiding principle. No matter how obnoxious it is, how racist it is, we don't want the state to decide who has the right to speech. We take this very, very purist position that the price we pay for a free society is putting up with this crap. Mr. Roberts, who as a Presbyterian minister had preached and advocated for racial justice in disadvantaged parts of New York, Chicago, and Cleveland before becoming an ACLU leader, died in Mount Auburn Hospital in Cambridge Tuesday of a blood infection. He was 89 and had lived for decades in Cambridge, from which he bicycled to and from the ACLU's Boston headquarters. As he turned a small office into a legal force in the state, Mr. Roberts, who was not an attorney, hired lawyers who argued and won cases that still resonate. He really laid the foundation for the ACLU Massachusetts as it is today, said John Reinstein, a former legal director of the chapter who is now retired. John came in and said, "We can do more." Colleagues said that the most lasting case in the ACLU chapter pursued under Mr. Roberts' direction was Moe versus Secretary of Administration and Finance, which is still in the news. After the United States Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision in 1973, we faced immediate and strong pushback as state and local politicians sought abortion access restrictions, Reinstein said. As ACLU attorneys, he and Nancy Gertner, now a retired federal judge, prevailed on the Moe case, which ensured far-reaching abortion cases in Massachusetts. The state Supreme Judicial Court ruled in 1981 that abortion is a protected right under the state constitution, even when Medicaid funds are necessary. That decision continued to preserve abortion access in Massachusetts after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe in 2022. At work and at home, Mr. Roberts was known as a feminist in an era when the term wasn't often applied to men. I simply have never met a man with such great respect and fairness when it comes to women's issues, his wife Kathy Roberts told the Globe in 1992. It's almost like he's from another planet. He's the most non-sexist man I know. Under his leadership, the ACLU established projects to focus on the rights of women and people of color, to protect privacy, and to develop a rights curriculum for public schools. His greatest passion was for racial justice, and that was reflected in every aspect of the organization's work under his leadership, said Carol Rose, who succeeded Mr. Roberts as executive director of the ACLU of Massachusetts. His leadership helped shape the ACLU's Driving While Black or Brown campaign to analyze law enforcement data and curtail racial profiling in traffic stops. While Mr. Roberts was executive director, the ACLU filed suit in the mid-1980s against a Massachusetts policy barring gays and lesbians from adopting children. In 1991, the chapter office called for the legalization of marijuana. Free speech issues, large and small, often shouldered their way into the news, however. In 2000, ACLU asked the Boston Public Schools to annul a high school student suspension, assigned to write a horror story with a suspenseful ending. The student wrote a fictional account of the murder of a teacher, a tale that frightened school officials. It's such a violation in the principles of free expression, Mr. Roberts told the Globe. If you are going to have creative writing, the last thing you should do is punish kids for what they wrote. Born on February 24, 1935, in Glen Ridge, New Jersey, John Roberts grew up in neighboring Bloomfield and was one of two siblings. His father, John W. Roberts Sr., was a banker, and his mother, Dorothea Williams Roberts, was a watercolor artist and substitute teacher. Attending public schools until he finished his early education at the private Mount Hermon School of Massachusetts, Mr. Roberts enjoyed a background of much privilege, which he really acknowledged. His granddaughter, Sasha Forbath, wrote as part of a school report an oral history interview she conducted. He graduated with a bachelor's degree from Dartmouth, where he majored in psychology. After graduating, what I had an interest in was social justice, he told Sasha, who died in 2020. That led him to work on the East Harlem Protestant Parish in New York. The Protestant chaplain of Dartmouth, who had been a mentor, encouraged Mr. Roberts to attend Union Theological Seminary, from which he graduated with a master's in divinity degree. He worked at a church agency in Chicago, and then with the progressive inner-city Protestant parish of Cleveland, where he led the outpost ministry's integration effort to establish bonds between the suburban and city churches. A subsequent organizer job at the ACLU Chicago office led to the 1970 offer to lead the Massachusetts chapter. In 1959, Mr. Roberts and Kathy Dreyer married. He was a co-founder of the Dandelion Preschool. Correction. She was a co-founder of the Dandelion Preschool in Cambridge, retiring after many years as a teacher and director. John believed in human rights for everyone, she said in an interview, and he worked on it all of his life. Correction. And he worked on it all of his life. An avid gardener until last year, Mr. Roberts found unlikely places to metaphorically plant seeds for critical thinking about civil rights, delighting in going on conservative talk shows as a guest to speak with earnest zeal that recalled the urban parish minister he once was. Though constantly on call and fielding numerous media requests for quotes about all kinds of court rulings, Mr. Roberts was always there for all of us as a dad and as a grandfather, in the small ways and the big ways, said his daughter Caitlin of Cambridge. He celebrated us and believed in us. Teaching his colleagues and family by example, Mr. Roberts knew he had to be unpopular sometimes to do the right thing, said his daughter, Allison of Cambridge. He had the personality where he could just let things roll off his back. Our strong moral compass comes from him, said his granddaughter Natalia Forbath of Cambridge. He is the one who taught us about civil rights and to treat others with kindness. As an observer during a correction officer's strike in the Walpole prison in the 1970s, Mr. Roberts met with inmates in their cells, and he was on Boston streets, keeping an eye out for civil rights violations during demonstrations over court-ordered busing in the school desegregation era. John was an extraordinarily courageous guy, Reinstein said. He was not on the sidelines. He was in the fray. In addition to his wife, two daughters, and granddaughter, Mr. Roberts leaves a son, Jonathan of San Pedro de Macorís in the Dominican Republic, and two other granddaughters. A celebration of his life and work will be announced. I've been really lucky, he told the Globe in December 2002, at the end of his ACLU tenure. I ended up in the perfect job for me. Nancy Murray worked closely with John Roberts for many years when she served as the education director of the ACLU of Massachusetts and remained a close and long-term friend to this day. This Week in Palestine invited Nancy to record a remembrance, and she offered this as a moving tribute.
If you ever wondered what Martin Luther King Jr. meant when he said the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice, you need look no further than the exemplary life of John Roberts. I met him 37 years ago in 1987 when he hired me to be education director of the ACLU of Massachusetts. He was serving as just the second executive director of an organization that had been founded in 1920. A position he would hold for 33 years. Long before he retired from that position in 2003, he was known around the Commonwealth of Massachusetts as Mr. Civil Liberties. Having gained political consciousness during the years of the McCarthyite Red Scare and having participated in the civil rights movement, he was determined to defend the rights of all people, foremost among them, the right to dissent and be free from government surveillance and repression. Very soon I discovered how fortunate I was to have John as a boss. I had held my job at the ACLU for less than a year when I was invited to travel to Palestine as part of a small human rights delegation to to investigate Israel's repression of the First Intifada, an unarmed uprising of the entire civil population. John had no problem with my accepting this invitation. After I returned and made Campaigning for Palestinian Rights the center of my extracurricular life, he was always supportive and shielded me from the complaints of those board members who were critical of my work for a free Palestine. Once he had retired as executive director and had the opportunity to travel with his wife, Kathy, in a delegation to Lebanon led by Elaine Hagopian, where they learned about the plight of Palestinian refugees, he and Kathy fully immersed themselves in the struggle for Palestinian rights. The public respect John had earned through his years with the ACLU and his extraordinary skills as an orator and writer were put to good use as he inspired confidence in those who heard him describe a life in occupied Palestine. John was a truth-teller who could not easily be refuted or condemned. After he assumed the mantle of host of This Week in Palestine, following the death of our dear friend Sharif Fahm, John made it possible for a growing number of Palestinian voices to reach the Boston area and beyond. His Sunday morning program educated countless listeners. With John in the radio booth and Kathy's tireless activism on the streets, the Roberts duo was a powerful force in our efforts to change U.S. policy and bend that arc towards justice for Palestine. Like so many of you, I lament the loss of John at a time when a new repressive McCarthyism is rearing its head, this one aimed at the silencing of those who embrace a free Palestine. But I know the seeds he has planted will grow and bear fruit, and his example and spirit will be with us for years to come. John Roberts, presente.
And that is our program for this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. If you want to hear the program later in the day, or at any other time of the week via the Instant Archive found on the WZBC homepage, simply click on WZBC's Hour by Hour Audio Archive, then choose Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. Please note that each hour on this archive expires 2 weeks after it's made. You can also stream This Week in Palestine online every Monday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, kkrn.org. This is a community radio station in Round Mountain, California. All but the most recent few of our post-2007 editions are available on our permanent archive at truthandjusticeradio.org. Click on This Week in Palestine Archives. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts.